God.
And we saw last week that we're talking about God, what He is, what it is, what God is beyond our ability. All we can talk about is what God does. The point I ended up with last week, I'm not sure we are on the same wavelength, is when you talk about action by an agent, you're not just talking about something that happens. I know we say, my car is running well, but that's not the same thing as saying that the racer is running well. Because for the car to run is merely something that happens. For the racer to run is something that the racer does. It's an action. On the part of the car, it's not an action, it's just the event. To describe the car's running, all you have to describe is what happens. To describe the racer's running, you have to describe what he's thinking, what his goals are, what his motivation is. Here, the picture is not describing what happens, but rather describing God as an agent, describing God as acting. Describing God as acting means describing a will with its results. That's the picture we're going to have. A will with its results. What it is that has the will, we're not going to be able to describe. That's the what of God. The doing of God is really doing, action. So we will want a description of the goal, or goals, primary goal, subsidiary goals, means to fulfill the goal, and what happens on the basis of that will. That is what we will be able to describe. And as I told you at the end yesterday, what we will end up with, this is the Ramchal's way of putting it, is two parallel buildings, two parallel structures. On the one hand, you'll have a whole set of goals and means, so to speak, on the mental side. And on the other side, you'll have what happens corresponding to those goals, means. But the bridge, how the mental side brings about the events that happen, for that they don't have any information whatsoever. How an unlimited, purely spiritual being brings about events in the physical world is something about which we have no understanding or description. When our oldest son was, I think he was 3. I was driving him someplace. He was in the back of the car, in the car seat. He said to me, Abba, does God have a mouth? I said, no. God doesn't have a mouth. He's not physical at all. So he said, well, then how can he talk? This is what I need for my 3-year-old, right? What are you going to do? He's 6. I said, listen, you know, God created the whole world, right? So he created the whole world. He created trees and stones and the stars and the oceans. He creates air. Now, sound is just airwaves. So we could create airwaves, right? So there was silence from the back of the car for about 20 seconds. He said, Abba, if he doesn't have a mouth, he can't talk. Period. That was that. Yeah. Well, I guess that's right. I mean, talk, the way we talk, you know, that's correct. What he does isn't what we would call talking. He doesn't vibrate and thereby cause airwaves. No. He is a purely spiritual being who has a will. It is his will from time to time that the air vibrate, and then the air vibrates. But how his will makes the air vibrate, we really don't have a clue. Nothing in the Kabbalah talks about this. Or the Ramchal, all you get is two parallel descriptions. You get a description of the, you know what it's sort of like? It's sort of like the way you use a computer. You know what to type in order to get something to come out. You probably don't have a clue what's in between. What's in between the keys and the printer? Well, I don't know. Some spaghetti inside a box. I don't know what's going on in there. And frankly, I don't want to know. All I want to know is when I press the right keys, I'll get the right screen coming off. The rest of it doesn't interest me. That's right. You have no idea what's going on in there. People who do are making a lot of money fixing the broken ones or creating new ones. So here too, all we have is the will versus the results. That's it. Now, as I told you on Thursday, the key element then of will is the purpose. If you understand the purpose in the will, then you understand where it's going, what it wants, you understand what's valuable. Subsidiary to that, you understand the means by which the will is going to carry out its purpose. And as I said over and over again, I just don't want this to get confused. The purpose doesn't have to be external to the will at the moment. Usually we think of a goal, we think of means, the means are one thing and the goal is something else. It doesn't have to be that way. The will may be that this thing itself happened. So the will has a goal, but the goal might be the immediate thing that's happening. Or it might be that something will happen later and then reduces to a particular act that will at the moment to do something in order that something else later happen. Either way. So the first question in understanding God, what we can understand of God, is what's the purpose? That is the key question. And as we said last time, Thursday and Wednesday, the only way we can know anything about his purpose is if he tells us. This is not something that we can divine on our own. Now, he has told us that the purpose of the creation is the expression of loving kindness. That's it. That's the purpose. It means, philosophically, you have a gigantic task. Everything that happens must be seen as an expression of loving kindness. Because there ain't nothing else. There are no other principles to appeal to. No other ideas to appeal to. It's a totally unified system. There's only one thing, the expression of loving kindness. Yeah.
Loving kindness is what is good, everything good?
Loving kindness means benefiting, doing good, creating good, giving good to another. That's what it means. Now here, I want to introduce you to a distinction. I've been talking about this for about 20 years or more. I was very gratified to see a philosopher whom I have a lot of respect, though I have some misgivings, John Searle, used this distinction in his latest book. And he used it quite centrally. I was very happy to see somebody's talking about it. When you say in English, I did A because of B, for the sake of B, you could mean two different things. You could mean A was a means and B was the end. I did A in order to get B. Or you could mean that A and B are really the same thing. But it's the B aspect of the thing which explains why I did the A aspect of the thing. But they might be the same thing. I'll give you two examples so as to make this distinction clear. Very important to have this in mind because sometimes people shift from one to the other and not aware of the shift. Let's imagine that in my backyard there's a hill. And I want to see over the hill. So I built myself a tower in my backyard. That's just as tall as the hill. Since I'm too tall to stand up another 5 foot 10, I can see over the hill. So I built the tower in order to see over the hill. Building the tower is the means. Seeing over the hill is the goal. They're two entirely distinct actions and events. Indeed, let's imagine that I finished building the tower at night, when it's dark. So I can't see over the hill. So it'll only be in the next morning, when I climb the tower, that I can see over the hill. Building the tower was finished at night. Seeing over the hill was the next morning. They're two entirely separate events, except that building the tower was for the sake of the second event of seeing over the hill. Now, by contrast, let's imagine that I owe you a favor. You've done me some good turn. I owe you a favor. So I ask your friends, what does he need? What does he want? What could I do for him that he would appreciate? And they say, well, look in his backyard. There's a hill, see? And he would love to be able to see over that hill. So if he had a tower in his backyard, then he could see over the hill. He'd really appreciate that. I say, wow. Thanks very much for telling me. Now, I happen to know that you're going on vacation to the Bahamas for a month. So while you're away, I build a tower in your backyard. Now, someone passing by says, could you explain why you're building a tower in his backyard? Why are you doing that? And I say, well, see, it's like this. He's done me a good favor, and I want to repay his favor. And I asked his friend, and his friend told me that he would appreciate a tower in his backyard. So I'm building him a tower in his backyard in order to do him a favor, right? In order to. But notice that building the tower in his backyard is doing the favor. That's all there is to it. When I've built it, I've done it. It's the whole thing. In this case, the building the tower is the favor. Only this construction project, putting up the logs and tying it up with iron bands and putting in concrete, you know, and then sticking up the ladders. And what are you doing here? Building a tower. Why are you building a tower in his backyard? In order to do him a favor. But the in order to is not means to ends. The doing the favor isn't something else that will happen later on the basis of this. The building of the tower is doing the favor. It's just that when you see it, if I'm building a tower and you don't know anything else, you can't imagine why I'm doing it. But I tell you that building this tower is doing him a favor, then you understand why I'm building the tower.
Can't you just say that the favor is allowing you to see over the hill?
Well, I suppose you could, but you don't have to. My point is that it's enough to say if he wants a tower, now he's got a tower. In other words, when will he thank me? You know, he could get a report from his friends while he's in the Bahamas. Guess what you have in your backyard? A brand new tower just as tall as the hill. Couldn't he email me and say, gosh, you did that for me? Thanks so much. You've done me such a wonderful favor. And I have. And the favor is complete. And even if, God forbid, let's say, in the Bahamas, he goes blind. And he never gets to see over the hill. I still did him a favor. Because he wanted the tower. Then it wouldn't be a favor. Then it would be a mistake. Correct. But all I need is an example to show you how doing A in order to accomplish B can be true when A and B are the same. I don't have to say it's always true. I'm just saying it can be true. Just illustrating an idea. Okay, so now. Yes.
Isn't the whole reason he wanted his powers to see over there?
That may be so. So what? But doing the favor is getting him the power that he wants. And he already realizes that he's received something of value. If I give somebody money, he only wants the money in order to spend it. But when I give him the money, I've done him the favor, haven't I? He now has the money that he wants. Of course he wants it for something else, but so what? Now, when we say that loving kindness is the goal, that leaves open two possibilities for everything else. Everything else is going to be for the sake of achieving loving kindness. Everything else is going to be for the sake of loving kindness. But I've told you now that for the sake of has two meanings. It can be means to ends, or it can be the other thing is the loving kindness under only another description. And once you see that it has a description of loving kindness, so then you understand that it's also loving kindness. It's also part of the goal. So if now we have something else, Q. Oh my gosh, how did Q get in? Why is Q happening? The general description will always be Q is for the sake of loving kindness. But it might be two possibilities. It might be that Q itself is not loving kindness. But it's a means to the end of loving kindness. That would be evil. Evil itself will not be loving kindness. But it will be for the sake of loving kindness, because loving kindness is the only goal. On the other hand, there'll be items, and we'll ask, why are they there? And the answer will be because they constitute loving kindness. And you'll have to explain how they constitute loving kindness. They themselves are loving kindness, but you don't see it in this description. When you fill in the rest of the facts, you'll see that they are loving kindness. So you have that, those two possibilities. But everything's got to come under those two possibilities, because there's only one goal, and that goal is loving kindness. You with me so far?
What is Q? I'm not
following. Q could be anything else. In other words, if I say that God created the world for the sake of loving kindness, that's the only goal, that's going to immediately raise loads and loads of questions. Where's pain come from? Why do people die? What is free will for? Why didn't he just give us, you know, why did he treat us like horses and give us lots of hay? Right. All these questions have to be answered under the general rule that loving kindness is the only goal. So sometimes the answer will be, well, look, you're right. Pain is terrible, and pain certainly doesn't look like kindness, and, you know, you expect someone to treat you kindly. You don't expect them to put on the iron thumb, you know, and give a squeeze. But I'll show you that this thing is needed for kindness, a necessary means to get to kindness. That's one kind of answer to the question, what's it here for? If kindness is the only goal. Q might be something else, what's called the Gilui HaYichud, revealing God's unity, where God hides, so to speak, hides his presence and gives us the challenge of discovering his presence. Now there, the answer will be, not that that's a necessary means to the good, but that itself is the good. When you understand how that works within the nature of human beings, the nature of the world, the relationship to God, you'll see that revealing his presence where he was hidden is itself the loving kindness. So it won't be a means to, it'll be in and of itself. Sorry, say again?
So Q, the undefined question to the answer of loving kindness.
Q is an item which on the surface does not appear to be related to loving kindness, like pain. It looks like it's not related, or maybe it's antithetical to loving kindness. So the person says, when he hears loving kindness is the only goal, the person says, what? Loving kindness is the only goal? How come there's pain? How does that fit with loving kindness? So Q is an item which doesn't seem to be related to loving kindness in the right way. It doesn't seem to be part of the goal of loving kindness. Now the answer will be either Q is a means to the goal of loving kindness, or Q itself is an expression of loving kindness, though you don't appreciate that in the condition that you're under. Yeah.
What you're talking about, it sounds kind of a, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of a diluted version of what the Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim when he says the creation is yours, that all Maaseh Bereishit and Maaseh Merkabah. And he gives an explanation, but is that what you're talking about?
No.
No?
I'm talking about Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato from a more Kabbalistic point of view. The Rambam in the guide seems to be agnostic on the purpose of creation. Indeed, he says, who says that we are the purpose of creation altogether? The world is so big and he can't explain all of it. In the guide, he has an entirely different approach to the psychopath. Yeah.
How do we know the aim is to have loving kindness?
As I said about 15 minutes ago, the only way we know anything about this is because he told us. If he hadn't told us, we would have no idea.
When does he tell us?
What's that?
When does he tell us?
Well, there's a famous verse in Psalms, the world is Olam Chesed Yibaneh, the world is filled with loving kindness. Since you said this, I'll move into this idea now. Now, this idea that loving kindness is the purpose of creation fits well with certain descriptions of God in the tradition. Let's think about motivation. We're talking about God as an agent. We're talking about his goals. But we're talking about God given a psychological picture. Why do agents do this? What kinds of goals do they have? What kinds of categories of goals do they have? Broadly speaking, you can divide goals into two types. Self-directed or other-directed. Certain things I do for myself, and certain things I do for others. By the way, don't get mixed up with altruism here. Doing something for somebody else might be evil. A might want to injure B for the sake of injuring B for no other purpose. Or A might want to benefit B for the sake of benefiting B for no other purpose. We're not talking about good and bad now. We're not talking about virtuous and vicious. We're just talking about where the motivation goes. Is it for somebody else or for oneself? Now, usually, if I have a motivation for myself, what condition am I in? Why am I doing X? I'm doing it for myself. This person might be a masochist. He might be doing it to hurt himself. Okay? I'm not talking about good or bad here either. Or it might be trying to develop more personal sensitivity for others. I don't care what it is. The point is, the goal here is to do something to or for himself. What kind of condition is the agent in when he's doing something for himself? Well, in a certain sense, he's not in an ideal condition, is he? Because he isn't where he needs to be. He isn't where he wants to be. He's doing something to change himself. Change his condition. Change what he has. Change what he is. So things with him are not ideal. Why am I doing X? So that I'll have more money. Oh, you're doing it so you'll have more money? So you don't have enough money. You don't have enough money. That's why you're doing it to have more money. Because you want to need more money for yourself. Why did I run 3 miles to the gym an hour and a half ago? Because I want to be healthy. And I know that if I don't run, I'm not going to be healthy.
Why do you run to a gym?
What's that?
Why do you run to a gym? If you go into a gym, it's to get healthy. Why are you going to run to that gym? And survive,
I suspect now that we are losing some of the seriousness of the discussion. If I were perfectly healthy and if running didn't matter, you wouldn't catch me dead in the gym. But so I'm running to be healthy because I'm not healthy without it, and I need to produce my own health. If I were healthy without it, so in a certain sense, if a person does something for himself, it means he's lacking. He's lacking. That's why he's doing it for himself. Now, if we picture God as not lacking anything for himself, then that seems to short circuit self motivation. That was motivation for oneself. So, motivation to do for oneself.
But the initial action of somebody doing something for himself would be loving kindness for himself.
I don't know what that means. But to me, that sounds like
I want to go to the gym to be healthy because I want to.
Okay. Now we have an Arcos jukebox over here, and Arcos jukebox over here. And to play it back 5 minutes ago, you'll see when I was asked what loving kindness is, I said it was benefiting an other. Loving kindness to oneself is nonsensical, and if it isn't nonsensical to you, then I'll be fine with that. That's not loving. So I'm describing the end, right? It is not loving kindness to do for oneself. That's selfishness, I think, to do for oneself. So, What I'm saying is selfish motivation, but now I'm trapped in the wrong term. I don't want it to sound negative. Even doing to make yourself a more sensitive person, whatever it is, if it's motivated for yourself, even for good things, if it's motivated for yourself, it means you are lacking. That's why you have to do it for yourself. You're lacking some item, like money, or you're lacking some characteristic, like sensitivity, therefore you're doing it for yourself. If you imagine an agent who isn't lacking, then motivation for himself isn't going to be on the table.
Yeah. So you're saying that since we know from the tradition that God is not lacking, we could deduce. The only reason we know that God is not lacking is because we know that from the tradition.
I said, that's right. Ultimately, it's going back to the tradition. I'm just saying that here's one part of the tradition which fits this part. Here's an integral, an internal relationship between two parts of the tradition, similar to what we did last week.
As if, according to people who try to prove from nature or prove from things like that, if they can prove that there is a God that created the world ex nihilo, as I said before, then they would prove that, and part of the argument before was that that would prove that he's infinite. And so if he's infinite, then he's not lacking. Once he's not lacking, we can run it back to here, so we don't even need the...
Yeah, every step in that argument is no good. I hate to tell you, but I hate to have a view. Every step in that argument is no good. First of all, this world might very well be finite. And if the world is finite, why would he have to be infinite? Okay, current research seems to indicate that it is infinite. At least it's going to expand without bounds because of the either quintessence or the cosmological constant or something else that's pushing the universe apart. But that's just a mere scientific finding. Second of all, and worse, this idea of infinite is a word that just floats around and nobody has any thought to what concept lies behind it. When we speak of God being infinite, especially when the medievals did it, what they meant was beyond all limitations. No limitation. That's one reason why it can't be described, because every description is a kind of limitation. Now, if he's really beyond all limitations, you can't see that for the world. The world is a concrete thing. It's a thing that has a certain shape, a certain size, a certain composition. How could you possibly see from creating this ex nihilo that he's beyond all limitations? Indeed, one might say, look, he produced this, for all I know, all he can produce is this and nothing else. Who says he can do anything more than what we got? No, I'm sorry, the argument, it just doesn't hang together.
But the Rambam says, Rabbi, that everything that has been created in time is finite.
Well, let me just remark that many of the things that Rambam says do not have this source in our tradition. When the Rambam says things like that, he never cites a verse. He never cites a midrash. He never cites a passage in the Talmud. He's using his own logic, based on things that he knows from various sources, in order to make a statement that he believes is true. And we are not obligated. We are not obligated to commit ourselves to things which don't come from the tradition.
Even if they're perfectly logic, because if you create a car,
yeah,
it's created in time. You run it, it expires. So why wouldn't the same principle apply to anything else that has been created within time?
From the fact that you pick one item in time and you notice that it runs down, doesn't follow that all items in time run down. For example, no one has ever seen a photon run down. Or a proton run down, and according to the latest theories, they better run down. The protons better run down. If they don't, those theories are all wrong. And they're a bit worried now because they've been testing them for a while, and they haven't seen one run down. So we definitely have things in time which no one has ever seen run down, and according to what we understand them, we wouldn't even know what it meant for them to run down. It's definitely not true that we're looking at the world with a preconception that everything has to run down. But even if everything we ever saw ran down, would that be a reason that everything has to run down? Maybe our experience is limited. Maybe we're just looking at these things that run down, and maybe other things not. Is there any abstract proof that anything that comes into existence in time has to can't run down? I don't see why. I really don't see why. Indeed, according to relativity, A photon has no time. Time doesn't elapse for a photon. It's frozen. Because it's moving at the speed of light. The speed of light defines time. A photon doesn't age. It always stays the same zero age.
But in that, I think...
So a photon which isn't absorbed, doesn't hit anything, will go on forever without ever hitting them.
But I read someplace else that it's not because of it. It's just, in order for something not to be governed by... To be governed by what you just said, it has to be like a black hole that travels faster than the light, and that's why it doesn't come out.
No. I'm talking about a photon. A person lights a match. A match gives off light. There's nothing to do with black holes. And the photons just start going. Now, if nothing catches that photon, nothing stops it, that photon will go forever and never change. Never change. Certainly never decay, never run down, never fall apart. It just bees. And it bees at the edge of time. It doesn't get any older. Nothing happens to it. So I don't think it's... certainly in our contemporary view, it's not necessary that something created in time has to run down and disappear. But I say again, I think this is a very important general principle. Wherever you find, whomever you read, and this includes the Talmud as well, if the statement is not one that comes from the tradition, then it doesn't have to be accepted. And you have to know, when the source that you're reading is reporting something from the tradition, that's one thing. When it's not reporting from the tradition, something else. That's very interesting. Maimonides, even in the Mishnah Torah, where he defines certain types of studies, which the Gemara talks about, and the Talmud associates it with certain verses, and he doesn't. He doesn't bring the verses. And I think the Rambam is waving the flag and saying, well, I'm going to tell you this is not part of the tradition. I have my ideas of what it is. So it doesn't have to be associated with
tradition. Well, he talks about that more in the book, and he says, he doesn't, well, he has the custom of not bringing sources for anything. And when he talks about that in Moran and William, he gives a very long explanation that what he's going to say is reserved a certain amount for only a select a few people. If you get it, you get it. If you don't get it, you don't get it. I'm going to talk about it with severity or anything. So
yeah.
I don't think that bringing sources or no quoted the Talmud. So.
First of all, the Mishnah Torah does bring sources. He brings sources, especially when there's a statement in the Talmud. The general rule is to quote the Talmud straight. And here he doesn't. And he quotes verses all the time in the Mishnah Torah.
Yeah, in the Mishnah Torah.
Well, there he doesn't quote the verses. At any rate, this is the situation for our description. The first goal is loving kindness, and everything else has to be explained as a means of or a way of expressing loving kindness. Now, there are a couple of philosophical problems that I'd like to do away with. And tomorrow we'll go into more detail about how the purpose works itself out. This goal of expressing loving kindness. Suppose someone asks, but why does he have that goal? What purpose is that goal supposed to serve? Why did he choose that goal? Now I'm going to introduce you to a piece of slippery logic. Suppose we answer this person. Oh, loving kindness? You want to know why he's interested in loving kindness? What the purpose of loving kindness is? It's G. What do you think the next move will be? The guy's asking the question, will now ask, why is he interested in G? Well, what's the purpose of G? What goal is he supposed to serve? I suppose we answer H. Something from some sector, northern England. We answer H. So what's he going to ask? Well, what's H for? That's what's that for I. We're going to be in trouble here, aren't we? Whatever answer we give, this guy is going to say, but what's that for? What good does it do? What purpose does it serve? What goal is it supposed to bring us to? And we finally get to Z. Because he wants Z. So he's going to ask, well, what does he want Z for? What's the purpose of Z? Now, Aristotle argued already 2,300 years ago that If you are determined to ask why, and to every answer you're determined to ask why again, only one of two things can happen. Either you go on forever. Why Z? Because of double A. Why double A? Because double B. Why double B? Because double C. Forever. Or you go around in a circle. Why do you want G? Because of H. Why do you want H? Because of I. Why do you want I? Because of G. Why do you want G? I told you already. H. And, as Aristotle pointed out, neither of those is a happy ending to the story. Because if it's going to go on forever, you're never going to get the ultimate answer. And if it goes round in a circle, then you're going to say, well, who needs the whole circle? A person, here's the moral. This is a hard moral to digest, but it's very important to keep in mind. A person who's made up his mind, as a matter of principle, to always ask why, has condemned himself to never getting an answer. And since he's condemned himself, he can hardly complain against us. A person who asks why, and asks why in good faith, that is to say, in the way in which he leaves open the possibility of getting an answer, must at least acknowledge at the outset that it's possible to stop somewhere. Why P? Because of Q. Why Q? That's just the way it is. That's the way it is. Or to put the same point backwards, a person who asks why owes us a price of admission. The question why isn't free. The question why has to be based on the position we're in being deficient. There's something wrong with where we are. There's something we don't understand. And he's got to point out concretely what it is that he doesn't understand that makes him ask why. He might say, look, why is this happening? Because something else could just as well have happened. And I don't know why this is happening rather than that. Okay, I understand. Then, many people do it this way, and this one's doing it that way. I want to know why he did this way rather than that way. Good. Then just say he did it this way is enough of an answer. Why did he do it? To get money. What do you want money for? Well, almost everybody wants money for something else. I would say all normal people want money for something else. So stopping with money is not an appropriate stopping place. So the person asking why can pay the price of admission. He can say, you told me he did it for money. The normal people don't do things for money alone. They want the money for something else. So tell me what the something else is. Good, you can pay the price of admission. But just to ask why, without explaining what's wrong with the answer we've given so far, is inappropriate. Now this applies particularly in motivation. Why is he working? To get money. Why does he want money? To buy a house. What do you want a house for? I have to ask for price of admission. The principal said, listen, different people have different purposes for houses. Some people want a house to live in. Some people want a house to show off. Some people want a house as an investment so that they can make money on the market. What does he want his house for? So that's the price of admission. Just saying he wants a house isn't enough. But if I say he wants the house because he wants a comfortable place to live, and then the guy says, well, why does he want a comfortable place to live? There, I think, it would be reasonable to say, why does he want a comfortable place to live? He just does. That's one of the things he wants. He doesn't have to want a comfortable place to live for the sake of something else that he wants. Wanting a comfortable place to live is an end on it, for some people anyway. Not for everybody, but for some people. Or, to take another example, which I think is equally an end, why does he want a comfortable place to live? Because he promised his wife. He promised his wife a comfortable place to live. Why does he want to do what he promised his wife? Because that's the kind of person he is. He's a person who keeps his promises. He doesn't keep his promises in order to do something else. Some people might, but he doesn't. And it's perfectly reasonable to understand the person who says, I keep my promises because that's the kind of person I am. So, in motivation in particular, it's quite appropriate, and I think it's quite natural for all of us, to come to a certain end, and if somebody says, but why, to tell them, fella, you're out of touch. You're just out of touch. In human motivation, there's an end to the whys. That's a person's first motivation in this string of psychology. and asking why again is just not a sensible question. So, when God reveals to us that his top motivation is loving kindness, at that point, if a person still has the itch to ask why, he needs to pay the price. What is the deficiency in this particular motivation that prompts the question why? What is it I don't understand when I've been told that his motivation is to express loving kindness? What is it I don't understand that needs further explanation? And, of course, the claim is that there isn't anything that you don't understand. That loving kindness is a perfectly reasonable place to stop a chain of motivation, just like pleasure is, and just like fully promises is. With me so far? Okay. The other philosophical thing back is this. He creates the universe in order to express loving kindness. That means to benefit, to give good, to create good for another. Who's the other?
Anybody besides you?
Okay, but in his case, in the case of God, who is the other for whom he's going to do this good?
We?
Huh?
Children of Israel?
No, for mankind. For all of mankind.
Why is not God?
Oh, so this immediately means that the rest of it is not part of the goal, or it's not directly part of the goal. That's true. I have to understand why. I have to understand what role it plays if it's not itself part of the goal. Now, the answer to that is going to be that it's for the sake of the goal, and the for sake of the goal can be articulated in two ways. Either it is another way of realizing the goal, which you don't see immediately, or it's a means to the realizing of the goal. Okay, that's the whole rest of creation has to be understood in those terms, and we'll get to that.
So basically, it's done by the theory is that, like, a worm eats dirt in Brazil, it's not like it goes
without being here. Oh, what? Is that a worm? What?
Oh, if a worm eating dirt in Brazil, it's not supposed to back into here.
Well, mankind. Yes. Ultimately, everything exists for the benefit that it will cause for mankind as a whole. Correct. That's correct. Everything, including the stars and all the rest of it. Now, however, suppose someone says, you're describing God as having a project. And you're saying that in order for him to fulfill his project, he creates us. Does that mean that he needs us? He needs us for his project. Wouldn't it be strange, odd, peculiar, and wrong to describe God as needing anything? God needs something? Isn't that sort of against what you said 17 minutes ago about God's motivation not being for himself because he doesn't need anything? But now, aren't you describing him as needing something? So, hasn't something gone off the tracks? Yeah. Okay, I think that's in the right direction. One answer in this direction is this. That's exactly what you said, but it's in the same direction. One answer is this. To say that God needs us, when the fact is that he creates us out of nothing, alone, without help, is a kind of harmless need, because it doesn't show that he's deficient in any way. What's wrong with needs is deficiency, weakness, lack. But to say that God needs X and God creates X by himself without any help or limitations from any other source, then you could say he needs it, but it doesn't show that he lacks anything, any weaknesses, any deficiencies, because the thing he needs, he produces for himself without any help from any other source, without any limitations. So I think there's really no challenge to God's perfection in saying he needs X if he can produce X without any help from anything else. That's one way out. Lutzata's way out would be more fundamental. His way out would be to say that the word need here is really a mistake. The word need is being used in a funny, non-literal sense. Here's my example. I have challenged you to a game of chess. And in the middle of the game, I take my knight, and I march it 3 spaces straight forward and take off your queen. And you say, you can't do that. And I say, why not? It's very easy. Watch, I'll do it again. I put your queen back on, I put my knight back up. 1, 2, 3, bang, off with your queen. What are you talking about? Knights don't move that way. I said, well, mine does. Watch, I just did it. Why don't you do it again? But we're playing chess. In chess, they don't move that way. In other words, you decided to play chess. Given your decision to play chess, you have to move the knight in the shape of an L. You can't move the knight straight forward. So when he said, I can't do that, he's not talking about what my limitations are. My abilities are, he's saying, given that you made this decision, you're committed to that. But it's all going back to my decision. Similarly, when we say that God needs us, all we're saying is, since he's committed himself, he himself has decided to express loving kindness, a consequence of that decision, there has to be something to whom he delivers a benefit. Because that's what loving kindness means. It doesn't mean that he needs to do it, it's just a consequence of his decision to express loving kindness. So strictly speaking, there's no need here. At any rate, this is the philosophical background. If there are questions about this, we'll start over this tomorrow. I'm happy to type this out so that it's clear. And then tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about how the world divides up, given that God's sole purpose in creation is loving kindness.